start recording now?
I think it's fine.
It's like
almost like a
reverberation.
I thought I did.
Shake it.
Thank God. There we go. I know, because I'm learning how to use mine too. Okay.
Well, one of them must be picking.
Good. Okay. Good evening to everybody.
Good evening.
Rabbi Lieben's not feeling well, so they called me like 4 o'clock and said, well, I teach tonight, so I am. But they also told me Parshat Toldos, which is, first of all, in Congress, it should be Parshas Toldos or Parshat Toldot. Anyway, that's what they told me, which actually started last week, but that's where I'm starting, so you'll just have to have a little repeat, I guess. But I'll try to go faster the first part, because I see that's where you got. So I did want to point out something important here, and I don't know if that's something necessarily that Rabbi Levy got to, but the Parsha starts with, and then I'll pass this section, the very beginning, so chapter 25, verse 19. And these are the generations of Isaac, Abraham's son. Abraham begot Isaac, and Isaac was 40 years old when he took to Rebekah, the daughter of Betuel, the Aramean, of Padan Aram, the sister of Lavan, the Aramean, to be his wife.
What page?
Did he discuss this at all? 125? Why does it open with this? We know this information already.
Start over. We were looking for
that.
Page 125, so it's chapter 25, verse 19, it's the very beginning. And it's setting us up for a new Parsha, but with information that we already know. So it's really a serious question. You know, part of what the Torah is doing is communicating ideas and a story and a line of history, but with no extra words. So whenever we get to extra words or an extra phrase, we have to ask, why is it there? So this is an important thing. We know this information already, and now we just spent two whole sentences discussing information that we already know. We know Yitzchak's lineage. We know Rivka's lineage. So why is it repeating it here? So it's repeating it here in order to emphasize the difference between the two of them. Yitzchak, both of them are righteous people. But Yitzchak was born to righteous people and was raised in a righteous environment. He's the son of Abraham, right? Rivka made her own choices at a young age. She was not raised by righteous people. She was raised by a difficult family, a thieving, tricking, conniving family. That's the environment that she grew up in, and yet, here she is, married to Yitzchak. She's one of our matriarchs. He's our patriarch. How do you blend these two families? Did they go over that at all?
No.
Okay, good. So there's new information.
All new.
Excellent. So it's setting you up for understanding what comes next. Isaac entreated the Lord for his wife because she was barren. And the Lord let himself be entreated of him, and Rebekah, his wife, conceived. So the Rashi there explains, what do you mean Isaac entreated his wife? Why not Rebekah? I mean, both of them could pray for she wants to have kids. So he talks about how they both prayed in different places for children. Well, they prayed across the room, and his prayer was accepted, not hers. He entreated. And God let him be entreated by him. So Rashi also discusses that and says, what's up with that? Why wasn't her prayer accepted? So there's this whole conversation about the difference of a tzaddik ben tzaddik and a tzaddik ben rasha. A righteous person, the son of a righteous person, or the child of a righteous person, versus a righteous person, the child of a non-righteous person. What's the difference between that? And then there's a whole long conversation over which is better in terms of who should lead a prayer service, who should be a teacher.
What he discussed last week was that when it says that he was opposite, that Isaac was opposite Rebekah, is that they were sitting on the corners of the altar and they were on opposite sides,
mm-hmm.
and that's where they were. That they went to a holy place, and he went to a holy place.
Right, they were on opposite sides.
So, but...
Physically, but that their prayer was different. Rashi discusses the difference in prayer.
Okay.
So I don't want to repeat what Rabbi Levy said, so I tried just looking at some of these notes, at your notes, just to have a little thought, but this is what I had thought to bring today, so I'm going to share this idea, that there really is a question over whose prayers do you hear, and who... I mean, it's a concept that we get from this.
No, I got what you're saying. I didn't understand that there were different prayers. Well, they would be slightly different because of different people.
Right. But so whose prayer gets heard?
That I thought it was both of them together.
Right, but it doesn't say that in the verse.
No, it doesn't.
And Isaac entreated the Lord for his wife because she was barren, and the Lord let himself be entreated of him, and Rebekah, his wife, conceived. It's a Rashi that says they both prayed separately. That's not in the text. The text itself, and it's the text that we look at and then try to figure out why does the text express itself that way exactly. So there's all kinds of different things, but it wants to, the text at first is pointing out their lineage to point out different things about them. So it is pointing out her righteousness. But then there's this whole conversation in the rabbinic sources about what's more righteous, a righteous person that comes from a righteous family so they have a whole lineage of righteousness, or a person who makes their own choice, a person who does their own movement. So I think it's an important thing to look at because that is one of the qualities of the Jew, is the ability to stand alone and to be different than the world, but different than their own family even, and different than their community. Even when their community is good, to be different. Not that we have to be different, but it's the quality of being able to be different. That's a particular Jewish quality. So I just wanted to point that out as a quality of strength. Abraham and Sarah are the first ones to bring us that quality. That's why they're called Abraham and Sarah, the Hebrews. Hebrew coming from the word Ivri, which means from the other side. So the first quality of the Jew, the reason why we're called Hebrews, is because we can stand on the other side. So we come from the other side geographically across the Jordan River, but we stand on the other side of the whole world. Look at us, right? I mean, we often, chunks of us get swept away with the world, but really who we are, our core identity as a people and the philosophy that we offer to the world is different than what the rest of the world is coming up with. So it is that core ability to stand alone that's a principal Jewish trait that Rivka right here, that's why it goes over their lineage. She's special. He's special because he comes from a special place. She's special because she made a special decision. So I just wanted to point out that it doesn't matter where we come from. It matters what we choose. So it helps if we come from a place of richness, but we can still choose into a place of righteousness. And that's what Rivka does here. So that's why it points out the two lineages. So then that argument of whose prayer do you accept first, who's better, there's really arguments on both sides. Is it better to come with a lineage? Is it better to make your own decision even if you come without a lineage? So, but why is his prayer accepted over hers? Why would you choose a congregational prayer leader that's a tzaddik ben tzaddik over a tzaddik ben rasha? And there's questions over that too. Finally, the answer is, if they're both equal stature, they're as their own human beings, then you look at their lineage. But a tzaddik ben rasha, who's at a higher level than a tzaddik ben tzaddik, you pick him first, because you go with the person who they are first. But then, after that, you look at lineage. So you've probably heard this joke before, but I'll just repeat it about lineage. You know how important lineage is to the Jews, right? So we're all about who we're related to, or many Jews are anyway. So there's a story of a rabbi whose brother is a thief walking down the street. And the rabbi sees the thief coming up the street, and he's like, he's embarrassed. He doesn't want to be seen with his brother. Everybody knows his brother's a thief. So he crosses the street. He shouldn't be seen next to him. So his brother sees what he does, and he says, "You!" He calls across the street, "You, whose brother is a thief, cross away from me, whose brother is a rabbi?" Right, so that's the joke. It's a Jewish joke. Okay, so that's it. So I just wanted to point that out as the beginning. It's really important, the choices that we make. Where we come from is important, and even if we don't come from a good place, a healthy place, we are responsible to make our own choices, and we're judged based on the choices that we make moving forward. And that's how she got to be the one who carried. Now, it's interesting to see, look at her question also, and I'm not going to go deeply into this, but something to think about. When looking at Torah text, it pays to think sometimes, what was the person feeling? So what does she say? She says, the children struggled within her, and she said, if it be so, wherefore do I live? What kind of question is that? Why should I be alive if they're fighting like this inside me? It's a weird question, right? So I just want to point out it's a weird question, and you could think about it. Why does she express her question that way? I'm not going to answer the question, but I want you to think. You know, don't just read, oh, so she said a weird question, next. Like, it pays sometimes to go inside the person and think, what is she thinking? Why is she thinking her life isn't worth anything? Is it because she made a decision, possibly, and now the decision's not working inside her? What is she asking? Why should I be alive if they're struggling like this inside me? Did you have a question before we go on?
Where did you read that?
I'm reading a slightly different version than you, but 22. And the children struggled within her, and she said, if it be so, wherefore do I live? And she went to inquire of the Lord.
And ours says, if so, why am I thus?
Why am I thus? Right. It's interesting because actually in the Hebrew it's much closer to that translation. Lama ze anochi. Why is this happening to me? So she wants to know what's going on. What does it mean? So but we all know the story. Then she has twins and one struggling with the other. and then they're born. Now, it's interesting because I think we've discussed before in philosophy sections of this class. I don't know if I've brought it to you before, but I'm sure, hopefully somebody has. The concept of being born as an incomplete person and being born in the image of God in that we're creators. And part of enabling us to be co-creators with God of humanity is that we personally are born incomplete so that we can participate with the creation of ourselves. So it's important that we be born not whole so that we can grow into wholeness through our lives and create ourselves. But it's interesting that Esav's name is Esav, which means done. He's fully cooked. So he's kind of born where he is.
It's as good as it's
going to
get.
Yeah, kind of. Right. He's not born with a lot of moving and shaking to do. Of course, he's born a baby, and he has to grow up. But he's born even hairy. Like, babies, I mean, we do see hairy babies, but he's hairy all over. Like, he's already a man baby, kind of. So, he's hairy. and Yaakov is named after heel. He holds back. Right? So Yaakov means hold back, and he was born holding onto the heel of Esav. So in that sense, holding him back, holding onto the heel, which is Ekev. Yaakov is his name, but Ekev is a heel. But it also means to hold something back. So, and we see later on that in the blessings, so let's see, we got to that, right? Well, we'll get to the blessings. I just want to point out one thing here, too. Another place where you could think when you're reading the text. The end of chapter 25, let's see, verse 31, I guess a little bit before that, Yaakov is cooking, he's making his red lentil soup, right? Did you talk about this last time? Mm-hmm. Yeah, a little bit. And he says, I want some right away, and he gives it to him, he sells him the birthright, and it just occurred to me today while I was listening on the way, I have the whole Tanakh recorded in Hebrew, not sung like we usually hear, but read out loud, like a book on tape, but in Hebrew. And it reads it so well, you know, because he has such expression. He has him coming in from the field. He reads just the Hebrew words, but he says, he has him coming in and says, like, give me some of that red stuff right away. And he's like, wait a second, first promise me that you'll send, that's like the voice tone that he uses for reading it. So as he read it, I was thinking, why does it have this verse last? So Esav despised his birthright, right? Verse 34. Jacob gave Esav bread and pottage of lentils, and he ate and he drank. He rose up and went his way. And then the comment is, so Esav despised his birthright. Really, so Esav despised his birthright should have been right after he sells it, right? Not after he finishes eating. That's, we're already past despising the birthright, right? If you think about how it's coming in terms of time. But I think it's saying it here because now that he's full, and he's still with his brother, he could look at his brother and say, I made a big mistake. I never should have sold it to you for that. I was so foolish of me. I mean, I was really hungry and tired, but now that I have clarity after I've eaten, would you please forgive it? But he didn't. He just got up and left, right? Which shows, even full, he didn't care. That's what shows that he despised his birthright. So off he goes. And let's see, the next chapter is when they go into, you did this chapter already, right? They go into, there's another famine, and he repeats the story with his father, where Yitzhak goes with his wife to, they don't go to Egypt, but they do go into another kingdom. And he lies and said his wife is his sister so that She won't be taken by somebody else. And it's just interesting to think about the concept here of within the other nations, there's a very strong concept of the sanctity of one's wife. And it's interesting also to see in the Torah, it's not something I thought about till recently, I think somebody pointed it out, in the rape of Dinah, did we get to that yet here? No. You'll get to that, right? Coming up, when the brothers take revenge against the rape, and it's a brutal revenge, they kill a whole town for the revenge, but nowhere in the text does it say the other nations around the other tribes objected. Because everybody gets that the honor of your sister, you protect that. And a girl, you're going to rape a girl? She wasn't even a woman, she was a girl. That there was a sense of morality among the nations around, both there, as a proof there, that's not in the text that they objected, and here, that the king says, how could you possibly say it's your sister? I mean, you might have brought a huge catastrophe upon us. One of our nation could have slept with her. And then what? We'd all be sinners. And you would have brought that upon us because of your lie. So he was concerned. And it's interesting, why did he lie? Because he knew people care more about another man's wife than about a man's life. Right? They're not going to take a married woman. I'll take a widow. So they'll make her a widow to take her, but they wouldn't take a married woman. So that's why he lied, was to protect himself. He didn't want to be killed so they could take her. But, I guess, immodestly, they left the window open when they were doing the married thing, and the king looked over and saw, it says in the text, here in the English, I think it says he saw him sporting with her. But whatever, he saw them behaving like man and wife, and that's when he called them to task. Meanwhile, he stays there for a little while, and eventually he's sent out as... Pardon?
Where
they're in the kingdom of Abimelech, in verse 26. So Abimelech is the one who takes him to task. That's verse 10. What hast thou done to us? One of the people might easily have lain with thy wife, and thou wouldest have brought guiltiness upon us. And then Abimelech charges all the people and says, don't touch, this is a protected couple. And they live with them for a while. That there is a famine, as we know, that's the whole reason that he went, because that chapter opens up with, now there's a new famine, in addition to the famine that there was in Abraham's time. This is Isaac's famine, that's why he goes looking for food. Now he's in the kingdom of Abimelech, the wife's issue has passed, and now he plants a field, and the field yields 100 times, which means you can't get 100 times yield in a famine year. You're lucky if you get anything. So the text says 100 times yield, just to show that he's blessed. You know, what he put his hands to just grows and grows. So let's see if it says here where you can see that. Let's see. Anyway, he grows. He increases his... What's your question? Thank you. Yeah. He increases his holdings. He increases his flocks and everything that he owns, and he becomes too big to have as guest any longer. So Abimelech says, go, and off he goes and moves back into the traditional land that he's initially given, the land of his father. Now it's interesting, as he gets to the land of his father, what happened? But the Plishtim, which is the name that the Philistines, that's the name that the Romans bastardized and changed into Palestine, it's from the Philistines, in order to hurt the Jews, really. After they destroyed the Second Temple, they changed the name of Canaan, or whatever it was called at the time, Judea, to Palestine, so that it would look like it belonged to these people who did live in the area at the time. And so that became the name of the land, which stayed that name, and particularly later than with the mandatory Palestine and the British, and the Jews were called Palestinians at first, of course, until the State of Israel, when the Jews became Israelis and the leftovers became Palestinians, whoever wasn't Jewish, whoever wasn't a member of the state. Anyway, so, but it's interesting to see a similar type of behavior, because here you have Abraham's family digging wells and the Philistines filling them up, right? So one group trying to make some progress and the other group trying to stop that progress. So it's rooted in here. It's earlier, too, with Isaac and with Hagar and Ishmael. But just to see what's going on here. So we have this well thing, and we have Isaac redigging wells that his father already dug, that the Philistines had filled up with dust and earth to try to make it difficult for them to own the land. So he redigs wells that were dug initially. Wells, often in Torah, they're filled with water, but water represents Torah. So digging a well is seeking Torah and covering Torah. So while they did certainly have to have water, and you can read it on the pshat level, on the surface level as well, that they were seeking water for their flocks, but Isaac had to create his own relationship with God and his own relationship with Torah and his own digging down. He couldn't just rely on Abraham's achievements. So he had to do his own digging here. So that is part of the concept of digging wells, and wells all together representing water, Torah representing water, which is why we have the concept of derech eretz kadma l'Torah. Good manners precede Torah, because water has no shape, right? It takes the shape of whatever you pour it into. So we have to create a good shape so that when Torah is poured into us, it'll be beautiful, as opposed to an ugly shape. If we have bad character traits, then even Torah poured into us, we're still ugly. We make the Torah ugly. So each person has to create their own relationship. And that's what Yitzchak's doing here. Creating his own relationship, and finally he gets to a place where he digs his own well, and it's called Rechovot. Rechovot means breadth. And it's the opposite. Rechav is the opposite of tsar, which is the root of the word tsuris. Right? Tsuris, when you have service in your life, it's because you're narrow and constricted. You're being squeezed in a difficult place. But the well that he digs in the end is called Rechovot, breadth, wideness, because he finally gets to a place of expansion. So, okay. That's Rechovot. And then he makes, once he digs up Rechovot, and there's a few more wells in there, and he makes a treaty with the people who are there, and he's able to move forward in life. And the end of that chapter is that Esav, having overheard conversations about who he should marry, who I think Isaac should marry, which we're going to get actually in this. We're going to get that in two chapters, I think. Yeah. He marries an extra wife that's a right kind of wife instead of a wrong kind of wife from the nations, just to appease his parents, I think. Or is that later? I think here's where he takes the bad wives, right? When Esav was 40 years old, he took to wife Judith, the daughter of Be'eri the Hittite, and Besemet, the daughter of Elon the Hittite, and they were a bitterness to the spirit unto Isaac and to Rebekah. So later on, he takes a good wife. But these were wives that his parents didn't like. Okay, so we end chapter 26 with Esav getting married twice. And now we have chapter 27. Okay, so chapter 27 is the blessing. So did you review that? Also, should I go quickly in this one or more?
Oh, I'm sorry.
Chapter 27, the blessing.
No. We
did. You did, right? Okay.
Kind of did that.
Okay, so we'll quickly go through that. Maybe we'll even make headway in the next. We'll see. Okay, so we have, it's interesting to note here, one of the things that maybe, I don't know if you did get this pointed out, but that's why it pays sometimes from Torah from a woman. One of the things this chapter points out, or helps you understand, is that Rebecca was on a higher level of prophecy than her husband Isaac. So that's why she, you might think that she tried to get this trickery across, because she comes from a household of trickery. Right, and so she picked her favorite son, and she's going to make her favorite son trick her husband to get the blessing that her favorite son should have. But that's not how our sages read it. Our sages understand that she understood the depth of the character of her two sons better than her husband. She had better vision. It's interesting to see that his physical vision is waning, but that's also a metaphor for the spiritual vision that he had. And that wasn't so strong either. So he wasn't able to see into the depths of Esav. One reason why he couldn't is because when Esav was in his presence, the one mitzvah that he was really good at was honoring his father. And he has a special garment that he wore when he honored his father. And so when he was in the presence of his father, he exuded the mitzvah of honoring father. And so his whole aura was an aura of mitzvah observance whenever he was near his father. So his father read that aura and got his psychic getting of his child was, this is a pious individual, a deep and lofty person, right? Because he was so in the mitzvah when he was in his presence. But his wife, Rivka, saw better. And she was able to see the comparison of the two boys in their daily lives, not just in the presence of their father. And she understood very clearly that it was Yaakov who was going to be the one who carries on the family name, not Esav. So she made sure, she orchestrated it so that he would receive it. So there's a truth in, you know, they say there's three kinds of true stories. There's stories that did happen, stories that could have happened, and stories that should have happened. Right? So each one has its own way of being true. It actually did, it could have, and it should have. Right? So she was seeing what should happen rather than what was about to happen, and she saw the truth of it. So it is a difficulty that we have this outright lie going on, and our commentators come to show how the words were used so that they, you know, they used the language carefully so it wasn't actually lying, it was just tricking. You know, like my kids used to say, I promise I'll do it later. And then I'd say, but you promise. No, I promised. Or my six-year-old used to not want to go to school. He'd say, I can't go to school. I'm six. Right? So they would try to use language very carefully so that they wouldn't be lying. But actually, it's still a lie, even if you're tricking, even if you're saying true things. So, but we do understand that her prophecy was higher, and she was able to see the essence of the two children, who were adults at this time, and orchestrate it so that the correct one would receive the blessing. Then we really hear the pain of Esav. I mean, I think it's amazing to hear his cry. At verse 34 in chapter 27. Where is that? Okay, got it? And the next thing, 137. I just wanted to see. Verse 34, 139. When Asa comes in with his own venison to give to his father, and he just and his father realizes, oh my gosh, I just ate it, just gave the wrong blessing, and he tells him, Asaph says, when he heard the words of his father, he cried with an exceedingly great and bitter cry, and he said, bless me too, my father. And he said, thy brother came with guile and took away your blessing. So as if he's answering him, I don't have a blessing for you, your brother stole it, right? And he says, isn't it right that he was named Jacob, the withholder, the holdbacker? Because he held me back twice. He took away my birthright, and now he takes away my blessing, which is really part of the birthright. And he says to him, don't you have a blessing left for me? Think of the pain in that sentence. Isn't there anything left? Nothing? You can't give me anything? You gave it all to him? So he says, okay, I have something left over for you. And he gives him, let's see. Esav lifted up his voice, and he cried, and his father answers him, and hears the blessing. Behold, of the fat places of the earth shall be thy dwelling, and of the dew of heaven from above, and by thy sword shalt thou live. And thou shalt serve thy brother, and it shall come to pass, and thou shalt break loose, that thou shalt shake his yoke from off thy neck. That reminds me a little bit, Lenny, of what you were saying about, weren't you the one who told me about what Ellen Hutt said? Right? So, by the sword shall you live, but you shall serve your brother. Who knows what that means? Because this is also talking about, you know, the negative descendants. It's not Ishmael, it's Esav, but they live by their sword. It's interesting, actually, to see this, living by their sword. Is it in the next chapter already? Then I can go into that next chapter. Good, I will. Okay, so just file this away. By your sword shall you live, right? That's Esav. Esav is called Edom. Edom means red. So both Esav and Edom are used interchangeably now for this person and his descendants. Edom is considered Rome. So the whole Roman thought and descendants, so basically Western civilization is descended from him. So by your sword shall you live. So just file that thought away. And Esau hated Jacob because of the blessing that he got. So there's the jealousy, and he plans to kill his brother. And Rebekah hears it and tells her son to flee. And off he goes. He's about to leave. She, again, though, doesn't tell her husband straight up the truth. She wants to protect her husband from knowing that the boys hate each other so much that one wants to kill the other. So she tells her husband, I'm sending Jacob off to my father's house, that he should go get married. Right? She's not saying, I'm sending him off to protect his life. So before he goes, he gets another bracha. Isaac calls Jacob and blessed him and charged him and said to him, so famous conversations that go on in Jewish families, marry a good person, right? Marry. So he couldn't say marry a Jew because there wasn't a Jewish people yet, but he was very clear about who he should marry and who he should not marry. And he had the conversation, and you see that conversation throughout the Torah. Thou shalt not take a wife of the daughters of Canaan. Arise, go to Padan Aram, to the house of Bethuel, thy mother's father, and take thee a wife from thence, of the daughters of Laban, thy mother's brother. And God Almighty bless thee, and make thee fruitful, and multiply thee, that thou mayest be a congregation of peoples. So that's interesting also, that his blessing is to become the congregation of peoples, right? And give thee, so not only should you become a congregation of peoples, the blessing continues, and give thee the blessing of Abraham to thee, and to thy seed with thee, that thou mayest inherit the land of thy sojournings, which God gave unto Abraham. So basically, he now knows who he's talking to. He's talking to Yaakov, and he says, you are the conduit of the family energy. Right? It started with Abraham. He had two sons. One did not inherit this. One did. That's me. I'm now telling you, it comes through me to you. You should inherit what Abraham was blessed with. That should go to you, not to your brother. So we do have a line through which it goes. And it's clearly going in that direction. I just want to make sure that that was pointed out back in chapter 25, yeah?
Is Isaac aware there is, I mean, do our forefathers understand or have a relationship with God and have a vision or prophecy?
Yes, absolutely. If you look back in chapter, I think it's 15, where Abraham gets the prophecy of what's going to happen to the, what's going to happen, right? It's called the covenant between the parts.
Okay.
Does that ring a bell with everybody? So basically, God speaks to Abraham and says, finally, somebody noticed me. I appreciate it, and now I will establish a relationship with you. And so Abraham says, great. And so God says, you've inherited this whole land. All this will be yours. It will belong to your descendants, and you'll be a special people to me, and all your descendants will be special. And Abraham says, but I'm barren. I don't have any kids. Who's going to inherit this? Is it going to be Eliezer, my servant, and his progeny? God says, no, it's going to be you. So, and he recognizes God in that. Is this ringing a bell, this story? Right? So he says, it's going to be you. You're going to inherit it. And then he says, but, so the I'm paraphrasing the question because it's phrased differently, but this is what he's basically saying. Okay, God, I understand how I'll be in relationship with you and why I deserve this. How will my kids earn the same privilege? Right? Abraham is the one who stands on the other side. So he's asking, how will they inherit it? So, and the answer to that is, he's cast into a deep sleep. And oh, first he has to, he's cast into a deep sleep and he's told, your children will be strangers in a strange land and they'll be tortured and they'll come out with a lot of stuff. But don't worry, you will be buried with you'll be gathered up and buried with your people. You're not going to go through that. That's the answer to his question, right? How will my children earn it? And that's the answer. God says, and he makes a covenant, right? He separates out the parts, he gets a bunch of animals, cut them down the middle, put a row of heads on this side and a row of tails on this side, and a fiery pillar goes between them. And that is one way that covenants were affected in ancient days, is that they separated animals like that and then walked through like a channel, And that was a way, kind of like, I mean, there's lots of ways to make a covenant. You could prick yourself and mix your blood, or spit and rub, right? Shake a hand. But that's also a method. So they made that covenant. So the covenant was, your children will be strangers in a strange land, and they'll be greatly oppressed and come out with a lot of stuff. But it's because you're going to be a great people. So still the answer is very enigmatic. But basically, paraphrasing God's answer, he's saying, okay, I see. You came to this conclusion on your own. But I hear your question. How will your children earn this? How will they become what you expect to become, the leaders of the world, the God recognizers and the teachers of God recognition on the planet? How will they get there? Don't worry. I will arrange a custom designed workshop where they'll go into Egypt and have their guts squeezed tight so that all the extraneous, superfluous stuff is squeezed out of them. And then with them squeezed that tight, I'll bring them to Sinai and let them absorb the Torah. And through that, that'll be step one, actually. That's only peoplehood 101 for the Jews, because we have the rest of history to get squeezed again and absorb other things throughout. But what transformed us from regular human beings into the Jewish people was that double process of super squeeze and then absorption of Torah. So they absolutely knew. The promise was made to Abraham, but they knew they weren't there yet. So they definitely knew they're headed for nationhood. So we're not called the B'nai Avraham, right? The children of Abraham. That's not what we're called. And we're not called the children of Isaac either. We're called the children of Israel. Jacob's name is changed to Israel, which maybe we'll get to. So Jacob's name is changed to Israel, I think, in the next parsha. So we're called the children of Israel because a group, we had to be a big enough group to change the world. One person can have great ideas, but unless they're able to make a critical mass, they don't change the whole planet. It was not Abraham and not Isaac who were able to come up with a critical mass, but it was Jacob. He had his four wives, his 12 sons. They knew prophetically there had to be a family of 12 sons who would carry it forward, which is part of the whole tragedy of having Joseph kidnapped, because now they were down to 11. So was it really going to happen? Because they knew it had to be 12. So there was definitely a clear prophecy that they had that it was going to be a family of 12 tribes that would be the family that carried this prophecy forward. So he's blessing him. He should receive that prophecy. Okay, and that's really basically, let's see. And that's the end, except for Esav redeems himself a drop in verse 9, the last verse in this parsha. Esav went to Ishmael, and he took unto the wives that he had Mahlat, the daughter of Ishmael, Abraham's son, the sister of, how do you pronounce that? Nebaioth, to be his wife. So we just see that in contrast, that he now takes a wife from the family. So possibly he's making it up a little bit. So we end off with that. Okay, let's move on to the next one. We want to make headway, right? Any questions so far? I mean, I want to bring you to the right place. I'll try to catch up a little bit if I can. Okay, so this is not the angel. That's after he comes out. Too bad, because I want to contrast that. Should I skip ahead to that? I guess not, really. Okay. So, Parashat Vayetze. So we have Jacob leaving Beersheba. And this is a classic line. The first line is, Jacob went out from Beersheba and went toward Haran. Again, superfluous words. If he's going towards Haran, if he's leaving to go somewhere, clearly he left the place where he was, right? Why do you have to say he left the place where he was and he went to the other place? So the commentary's answer on this, he was such a presence that everybody felt his loss. That's a separate phrase. Vayetze Yaakov mi Beersheba is its own phrase. And there's a comma there even. If you see, you probably learned this, but if you look under the Hebrew words, there's four words there, Vayetze Yaakov mi Beersheba. Underneath the shin of Sheva, you have like a little wishbone. Does everybody see that little wishbone? That little wishbone is called an asnachta. It's part of the trope for reading, but it functions also grammatically as a comma. So that makes a phrase out of that. So he left Beersheba. That's its own phrase. We don't have a period there, but we do have a comma there. So we understand that there's something about his leaving Beersheba that made an impression, and that was the vacuum that he created by his departure. So he created a vacuum by his departure from Beersheba, and he went to Haran. So you get two different things in this sentence. So off he goes to Haran, and on the way, he, let's see, does it say exactly in the text? On the way, we certainly understand that, this is not positive it's in the text or if that's just the concept, is he lays down and has his dream, but the place where he has his dream is the Temple Mount, what today is the Temple Mount. So on that place, on Mount Moriah, in what is now Jerusalem, is where Jacob has his dream. So he left Beersheba and he's on his way to Haran, but that's the place where he stops for the night. And he lays down and he has his dream. And he sees this famous dream of a ladder set up on the earth and it reaches up to the heaven and angels of God are going up and down, up and down. So there's lots of commentary on what those angels are. But one of the commentaries is that he sees four angels go up and down, and each one represents the four exiles that we'll experience. So it's a prophetic dream. And he sees the exiles that we'll experience, except for the fourth angel goes up and up and up and up and never comes down. And we're in that exile right now, the fourth exile, which is so much longer than any of the others were. The first exile being Babylon was, and quickly followed by the Purim exile, Persian Mede exile. Those two together, because they were back to back, were 70 years. And then the third exile is the Hanukkah exile, where we actually still in the land of Israel, just our minds were exiled out. That was just a few years. This exile, the Roman exile, the fourth exile, started at the destruction of the Second Temple and has gone till now. Is not over yet. So we have a tradition of four exiles, and we see it throughout in different midrashic sources. We have a tradition that it's referenced in the beginning of the Torah also. If you look back in the first verse, perhaps in a second, let's see. I'll read it to you. You don't have to find it if you don't want. The second verse, V'ha'aretz ha'ita tohu v'vohu v'choshech al pnei ha'tahom. Right, the earth was unformed and void, and darkness was on the face of the deep. That's a reference to the four exiles. Unformed is the first one, Babylonian. Void is the second one, Greek, where they wanted to kill us. Darkness is the third one, Hanukkah, because it was dark and we lit menorahs to light it back up. And the face of the deep is the fourth one, because it's so deep you don't even know how far it is. That's the one that we're in now. So we have this concept of four exiles throughout, and you'll see it referenced in different places. So one thing that happened in his dream was he saw the angels going up and coming down. There's lots about the ladder and the dream and the angels, lots of different interpretations, but that's one of them. So, and he has his own now prophetic vision. Now, one thing to understand with prophecy and all these prophetic experiences that they're having, even Abraham's, is that there's a qualitative difference between the prophecy of Moses and all other prophets. All other prophets, Moses is the only one that spoke face to face with God, so that the conversation would be like we see it in the text. Here we have God saying, I am the Lord thy God, God of Abraham thy father, and the God of Isaac, and the land upon where thou liest to thee, I will give it into thy seed. But he didn't speak to him that way. It wasn't couldn't of course be face to face, but we talk about Moses' prophecy being face to face. It came through dreams or visions, but there was a clarity. It was always given in a riddle or a dream or a vision, but with the solving of the riddle at the same time. So if you would see a ladder with four angels, so he doesn't just drop you off with a ladder and four angels. The prophecy allows you to understand each angel represents an exile, and how far up they go and down they come is how long the exile lasts. So you know what it is, it's just that God didn't say straight up, there will be four exiles, the last one will be super long. Right? But you totally get it from the experience that you had, the prophetic experience. So it's often written as if it was spoken, but we just need to understand that the way prophecy is given to other prophets other than Moshe is in enigmatic ways, but with the key to the enigma at the same time. Does that make sense so far? Just a concept to have in prophecy. Okay, so he gets his own prophecy here, where God ties himself back to somebody he knows. I'm the same God that revealed myself to Abraham and your father Isaac, and I'm telling you now, the blessing that you just got from your father, it's going to happen. Right? You just got the blessing that it should go through your seed, and it will. I guess I should end soon, right? Let's see. he woke up from his sleep, and he feels very clearly that he had that experience, and he calls that place Beth El, the house of God, because that's what's going to be built there. And he pours oil on it, which is one of the ways that we sanctify things or set things aside, is by pouring oil on them. And he sets aside the pillar and establishes that place as a holy place. So the place came from, you know, we have questions about, are places holy intrinsically, or things holy intrinsically, or they become holy because we invest in them, the energy that we have. So like, for instance, the Kotel, right? Is the Western Wall holy because it's the Western Wall? Is there intrinsic holiness in the stones because it held up the mountain that held up the temple? Or is it holy because so many people prayed there that each person in their prayers has invested it with energy? So that's not something that's solved in Judaism. It goes both ways. So here we have a prophecy happening. Did it happen because the place was holy? So that he slept, or was led to sleep, in a place that had a channel of holy energy flowing from it that he could be the receiver for, and then he consecrated it? Or did he have the dream there, and it's because he had that dream and that prophetic experience that made that place holy, and then through his consecration, later things happened there in that spot? So we leave that as a question. And I think I'm supposed to end, right, so that you can go to your next class. Right? Okay, so you at least got to the beginning of Vayetze. So, and maybe I'll get to come back and teach you some more. I love Chumash. Anybody who has questions, this is a fabulous book, series. So, it reads like a novel. It was written to read like a novel in the 1700s for Greek Jews. It was written in Ladino. So,
it's a different one.
It was translated into English. But it goes verse by verse, but it just tells the story. So you can just read it like a novel. But I use it, it's a lot to read. I have a whole shelf, and the whole shelf is just the five books, basically, of Moses with the commentary. But certainly if there's anything interesting that bothers you or you're curious about, this is a great place to just read it through. It doesn't have all the so-and-so said and so-and-so said kind of choppy. It's just a nice flow. It was meant to be read by shopkeepers in between customers. So you don't have to focus on it, but it has a lot of information.
Alexa, would you just say the title and the author so we could have them recorded?
Yes, I will. It's called The Torah Anthology in English, translated by Rabbi Aryeh Kaplan. But the author really is Rabbi Yaakov Cooley. It's not even on here. I think maybe that's because they didn't know that for sure. In Hebrew, it's called the Me'am Loez, so that's on the top of the page too. But The Torah Anthology, translated by Rabbi Aryeh Kaplan, and by Mosnayim Publishers. And it's a really pleasant read. So anybody who wants to read it for the Parsha, I have a friend who does it every year, and she just reads as far as she can get, and then she leaves a bookmark in where she got, so the next year she can pick up from that spot and keep going, because it's a lot sometimes.
What was the publisher?
The publisher, Mosnayim. Mosnayim, M-O-Z-N-A-I-M. Mosnayim means scales. Mosnayim Publisher. Good. Thanks.
Thank you.